From KCUR News, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Would you have guessed that the funeral of Meet the Press host Tim Russert would be a crucial networking event? This hour, we'll talk with the New York Times Magazine's Washington correspondent about how the elbow-rubbing game works inside the Beltway and why getting your name in print makes the difference between success and obscurity in the capital city. We'll also look at how increases in lobbying, the ubiquity and glamour of cable news, and more have changed the game in Washington. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Washington, D.C. is sometimes called this town, and the insiders who dominated it are referred to as the chattering class or the Beltway establishment or the political class, or more simply as the club. Author Mark Leibovich calls it something else, a carnival, a place turned upside down by money, lobbyists, a certain celebrity madness run amok, even ideology. Case in point, June 2008, the funeral of former Meet the Press host Tim Russert, which turned, Leibovich says, into a giant networking opportunity, a place to be seen as the various tribes of official Washington came together. Mark Leibovich's book is titled This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gildas Capital, and it sits firmly in the number four slot on the New York Times bestseller list. He's a chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He joins us this morning from the studios of NPR in, where else, Washington, D.C. Mark, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's only really one place to begin, Mark, and that's where you begin, which is the 2008 funeral of Tim Russert, known as the unofficial mayor of Washington before he passed, because he was constantly bringing together the members of all these different D.C. tribes that you write about here. Set the scene for us that day, which struck you, and what struck you about it, because the way this book begins is just absolutely remarkable.
Right. Well, first of all, I call him the unofficial mayor of official Washington. It's a very,
right.
very important distinction to make because actually, Washington D.C. is a metropolitan area, has its own mayor. He deals with city problems, but no, Tim lived very much at the nexus of media and money and politics, which is really the official Washington sweet spot where people really pay attention. Tim died tragically and suddenly at age 58 in June of 2008. His funeral, which was held at the Kennedy Center or the Performing Arts, was treated as a state funeral. I mean, it was essentially like a president had died.
Yes.
And you had the Clintons there and the McCains there and the Obamas there and President Bush, then President Bush was there. You had Democrats, Republicans, lobbyists, media people. I mean, all like you said, all the tribes were there. And I was struck by how this incredibly solemn event just quickly degenerated into a cocktail party, essentially, and how everyone was just networking and throwing business cards around and angling, trying to get Tim's job and trying to score interviews with the then-Democratic nominee or soon-to-be Democratic nominee Barack Obama and soon-to-be Republican nominee John McCain. And it became what I thought was just a perfect metaphor for what Washington has become. And I at that point, decided to sort of jump off and chart what this world has started to look like or really come to over a five-year period. And this is what this town reflects. So that's it.
Well, and all this happening, of course, at the funeral of Tim Russert, again, just absolutely breathtaking. You mentioned Bill and Hillary Clinton arriving at the funeral, and this is not a good time for them back in June of 2008 because Hillary had just lost the nomination fight to Barack Obama. You write this, Mark, true to her stoic and gritty precedent, Hillary is keeping her smile affixed like hardened gum and sending out powerful stay away from this vehicle vibes. But one woman very pointedly ignores that vibe. What happened next?
The woman ran up to Hillary Clinton and said, Senator, she was still a senator, and Senator, would you like to be a guest on, I guess, MSNBC's countdown tonight.
At the funeral.
At the funeral. Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, no. An opportunity like this cannot be lost. So Hillary looked at her and said, "It is a pleasure to meet you." And she kept right on walking. But I thought this was a most emblematic moment. Hillary was very focused, and the Clintons did what they had to do, which is what the Clintons do. Which is attend the funeral.
And again, at this moment, you know, the Obamas are ascendant. What do you recall about the hoopla that surrounded Robert Gibbs, who became Obama's first press secretary, from his presence at the funeral, because he had a whole beehive of activity around him, you know?
Yeah, this was the first thing I was really struck by as I sat there, which is Robert Gibbs and David Axelrod, who was the chief communicator for the Obama campaign, were just swarmed. I mean, there was an incredible sort of receiving line around them of people trying to quote-unquote congratulate them. That's usually code for, hey, do you think you can get the senator onto our show this weekend, or do you think you might check out my resume to maybe get a job in the general election campaign or in the White House if you make it that far. So you could sort of see the man of the hour were these two, and they were just swarmed. And there were other people like the Clintons who at that moment were sort of vanquished, although they're still the Clintons, so they were obviously fuss magnets. But definitely a great moment to sort of view who was up and who was down in the pecking order.
You know, and I love this next part of your story because, you know, you would think that Tim Russert would have been just aghast at what happened here. But you write very much that
he would have loved this.
And you say that he would have loved the outpouring from the power mourners, you write. And he also would have understood better than everyone that all of the speeches and tributes and telegenic choke-ups were never, not for a second, about him. They were about the people left behind to scrape their way up the pecking order in his absence. Wow. Yes. What a mouthful.
Tim Russert knew Washington better than anyone, and he knew these characters. I'd like to think he would have liked this book, besides the fact that it begins with his funeral.
Yes.
His family, Luke Russert, his son, has gotten a big kick out of all this. And I do think, though, that there were a number of the eulogies that day were of the but enough about me vein.
Yes.
I mean, everyone was telling them the stories about me and Tim this.
Yes.
And Tim gave me my start this. And I remember when I did this, Tim said this. So, it was, I think, quintessential to Washington. And Tim himself was quintessential to Washington, but not above the self-knowledge and sort of self-awareness to know exactly what would have been going on.
Again, our guest this hour, Mark Leibovich, his book titled This Town, it's a scathing look at our nation's capital and the culture out there. Ultimately, Mark, you describe Washington as a carnival. Why?
Because, while the rest of the country has struggled economically over the last few years, while the rest of the country has been utterly appalled, disappointed with the doings of the Capitol, both major parties, the media, the Congress. I mean, it's just been every institution in this town has been really, really sort of diminished in the eyes of the American populace. At the same time, you have had this incredible party breaking out in Washington. It has become by far the wealthiest metropolitan area in the country. It is home to 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the country. It has not hiccuped at all. The economy has not hiccuped at all. People are doing very well here. People are feeling very, very good about themselves here. It's the classic reality distortion field when you compare what's going on here versus what the rest of the country is thinking about the nation's capital. So I wanted to really, in this book, I wanted to just chart with great detail, with great specificity, what this carnival looks like. I think people outside of Washington fundamentally know that the government isn't working, the city isn't working, but in fact the city is working very, very well for Washington.
It's breathtaking. Reading this and reading about the funeral, it was both unsurprising and at once and also astonishing, Mark, right, as you look at all this. And again, as a guy who covered politics out here for a long time, not as much out there. Again, not surprising, but just absolutely, shame on them.
Shame on them. In fairness, this is a city that reflects America. It's a city that is supported by the American taxpayer and the American voter to some degree. And I think what a lot of people have said to me as I have talked about this book outside of town is that, I know people like this in my hometown, in my capital city, in my political environment. What's distinct about Washington is just it's all writ large, it's all televised, and it's all, again, it's the national government. But now, look, I think the mix that you speak of astonishment, surprise, also, you know, people seem to be enjoying it. So I think, I mean, this is not homework. I want people to be entertained.
It's not homework. It's definitely not homework.
Yeah, no, I saw people reading it on the beach and laughing, so that's all good.
Did you watch them reading it?
Yeah. It would be vain of me to admit that I did watch them. No, but I did take note of this, right? I mean, that's the thing about e-books. You can't always tell what books are people are reading. So when they actually have a full hardcover out and it's on the beach, I mean, I'm going to be psyched. So, I've been really gratified by the reaction, but I think at root, like you said, it's astonishing, I think it's depressing, and I think it's important.
You know, at the end of the day, I guess what you're describing is sort of why I couldn't work out there, but you have. I mean, you have spent a number of years out there, and the question you get asked a lot these days is, how do you square this idea? Yeah, you're writing right about the place where you live from your own perch inside the Beltway. How do you square those ideas?
Well, this is usually the part of the conversation where I contradict everything else I've said. But no, I mean, I guess my short and simplistic and maybe contradictory answer to that is it's actually a rather nice place to live if you can make the city work for you. And the truth is, my wife and I have jobs that we like. They happen to be in Washington. Our kids like their school. We like our neighbors. We like our friends. And that's all in Washington. So life is sort of what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. Now, having said that, I'm totally appalled by what goes on here. I think one thing about Washington that you need to learn really fast is it's a city, probably more than most, where you need to choose your friends pretty carefully. You need to choose people who you know want to be your friend or your kids' friends or your wife's friends, rather than, you know, they want to be friends with your job. Because, yes, I'm attached to a major news organization, so people might think it's expedient to be in my good graces. But now, look, I mean, I'll be run out of town after this book and I'll get to move somewhere else.
It hasn't happened yet, Mark.
Hasn't happened yet, but, you know, it's only been summer, so we're just picking up again.
They're just coming back to town, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, what has been the reaction? What are you hearing from many of the folks that you've covered over the years? We'll talk about Mike Allen as we go through the show today, and others from, you know, Mike from Politico, who was just out here in Kansas City a few weeks ago. What are you hearing from official Washington about what you've done here, Mark?
There has been an incredible disconnect between the reaction outside of Washington, which has been overwhelmingly, certainly positive, but mostly just astonished, like you said. Inside of Washington, no one has snubbed me. I haven't gotten any threats of physical violence or lawsuits or anything yet. But it's been most people are really focusing on the titter tatter, like who wins, who loses, mm-hmm. you know, what mm-hmm. little revelations came up, what embarrassing them. It's a classic sort of small minded Washington reaction. I mean, look, if I've made some people uncomfortable, and I think I have, I welcome that. I mean, I think it's a city that's very comfortable. I think the media environment here is extremely comfortable, and I welcome shaking that up. I mean, I think that's part of what journalism should be. But I also think that I've been sort of disappointed in, not surprised, but disappointed in how no one really has gotten their back up, because they just sort of shrug their shoulders and figure, well, if I'm in there, as long as they spelled my name right, that's good. Or if I wasn't in there, why wasn't I in there, right? Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been that bad. I mean, it hasn't been bad at all.
And that was Bob Dole's big line for years, Mark. Just spell my name right. Don't really care what you say about me. Just make sure you get my name spelled right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
Mark Leibovich is our guest. His book, This Town, it's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a terrific read. We're wondering, what do you make of Mark Leibovich's portrait of our nation's capital? He skewers it pretty good. How surprised are you? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @KCUR Up to Date. Again, the book This Town by Mark Leibovich. You know, Tim Russert himself, Mark, you know, behaved like he was a national leader with You talk about the way he sent gifts to people and the way he sort of comported himself at times. He knew he was in an exalted place, and that sort of allowed him to be free from he could sort of look down his nose at some of the ways Washington operated just because he was already on top of the mountain in a certain way. Talk to us about how he sort of acted as a national leader in a sense himself.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you know, he was smart. I mean, he made himself a spokesman for America in some ways. Now, obviously, he was good. I mean, he was a very good journalist. He conducted good interviews. He was, you know, he was combative, but I think he made for good television. He certainly got good guests, so he certainly deserves his due. But no, I mean, I think what he is emblematic of is at a certain point, the fame itself becomes more important than what team you're playing for, whether it's the media team or the Democratic team or the Republican team. I mean, everyone is in this big class of fame, and Tim sort of was the top of the heap at a time when, in our business, punditry sort of replaced reporting as the gold standard. I mean, the people that you see on TV are the ones who are making the money, the ones who are getting the speaking invitations. And so in some ways, I mean, you see these public people around and they carry themselves like politicians. I mean, it's the whole dance of the public man and woman, right? Which is, you know, you go through airports, you talk in a certain way, you're sort of gracious in a certain way, you give gifts in a certain way, you probably have hired people to send gifts for you. I mean, it's all the same kind of cult of being and belonging and insiderdom and fame that everyone here is striving for now.
You say that a focused and surgical ambition is vital to success in D.C., and the ability to be appropriately sheepish about it is even more so. Tim Russert excelled at that. And what do you mean exactly when you describe him that way?
Well, he was rumpled, right? I mean, rumpled is always very, very important. You have to be rumpled because it shows you're not trying very hard. You're just a regular guy. And again, I mean, I don't think Tim was inauthentic, but I do think that he came of age in a time when your brand, for lack of a better term, and that's a term that people use in Washington like probably nowhere else now. I mean, you needed to be liked in a certain way. I mean, I think people liked the Tim Russert, talked constantly about his hometown of Buffalo, that he talked about his father. I mean, he wrote a book about, a mega best-selling book about his father and his relationship to Big Russ, his dad. And made him a mythological figure, and, you know, was very, very good for Tim Inc. also. So, again, I mean, it's a media game that me, being just sort of a print wretch, can never really begin to understand, and you can't see me, but I'm not good looking enough to take advantage of this. I don't have the full head of hair that Tim did. But no, I mean, it's sort of the game as it's played today, and Tim was the master.
Tell us about your last conversation with him.
Tim, I never knew Tim that well. I mean, we didn't talk many times at all. I mean, he did what he did, I did what I did. But I remember I was doing a profile for the New York Times Magazine on Chris Matthews. And in the course of doing that profile, I followed Chris to a Democratic debate between Obama and Hillary Clinton in, I think it was like March of 2008. And in the course of doing that, I was walking through the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton in Cleveland, and I was following Chris Matthews around. And there was Tim, and Tim was coming back from a workout at the Ritz. And he was wearing a pair of rubbers of like leather
black shoes,
shorts, and a sweaty T-shirt. He was just coming back from a workout, and he had like white tube socks on. It was not a pretty sight. And so I walked away, and the NBC public relations guy who was walking with me said to me, "By the way, Tim's outfit is off the record." and at that moment,
a little late for that.
It was a little late for that. But I also never heard of an outfit being declared off the record before. But I knew at that moment that even though it wasn't, I mean, I probably wasn't going to use it. I had to use it because that was such an absurd and wonderful comment from the PR guy. I had to embarrass him. So I then put it in my story that the public relations guy for NBC declared Tim's outfit off the record. I then described the outfit in great detail. But I did have to call Tim and tell him. I wanted to give Tim a heads up. It's important to give someone a heads up in Washington.
That's something a little embarrassing might be coming.
Yes. Yeah, something's going to be coming in. And I told him this, and he just burst out laughing so loud.
Great story.
I was like deaf. I mean, it was like, he goes, well, just do me a favor. Just say they were rubber-soled shoes. And I obliged him. I said that they were rubber-soled shoes, but I did not honor the off-the-record request from the NBC FLAC. And I think this FLAC is now boasting of that to this day. I guess it was the highlight of his career, too. So I've made another career.
Yeah. Mark Leibovich is our guest. His book is titled This Town. It skewers Washington, D.C. Would you want to live out there or work out there? What do you make of Mark's portrait of our nation's capital? 816-235-2888 is our number here. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Gene from Prairie Village, good morning.
Hi, Steve. I thank you for taking the call. I enjoyed an interview I saw with the author on Bill Moyers and talking about the congressman moving off from congressmen and senators moving into
lobbying, right?
Lobbying. Yeah.
We'll get there.
And
yeah.
The disingenuousness of it all. But the main reason I called was I find so much now of what I read is just depressingly lacking credibility. I simply don't believe that they have any interest, that they have any sense of reality, and it's very depressing to me. Just as an example, I read in Parade magazine yesterday a quote from Marco Rubio's wife that if she's okay with politics as long as it's about service and not about power, and then
Gene,
she doesn't believe it.
You are taking the words out of my mouth. I read that in Parade magazine yesterday, too, and my wife read it, and she turned to me and she says, Steve, you got to make this one of your next columns, and you'll title the column, Really? With a big question mark, and use that quote to begin it.
Oh, my gosh.
That was so disingenuous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed that way anyway, I should say. Yeah.
You have to headline it, Thank You for Your Service.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Gene,
anyway, thank you for your work. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Great point,
thank
Gene.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Again, Mark Leibovich is our guest. What about this idea of, Russert has sort of moved on. Let's turn to what Gene was bringing up here, Mark, this notion that Washington has become this revolving door when it comes to, members serving, performing public service and then moving on to careers in lobbyists. You point this out that 50% of U.S. senators and 42% these days of House members leave office, then become lobbyists. That's 50% of senators, 42% of House members. What does that say?
Well, first of all, it says, if you compare that to 1974, when the figure was 3% for both, it says that the numbers have just gone up exponentially. But what it says is that Washington has become a place to come and settle and get rich. And it's this great contradiction between how politicians, when they want to be reelected or when they want to be elected, they'll talk about how horrible Washington is and how it's such a terrible swamp. And then they get here, and even if they're voted out, they will settle into the city like a whirlpool bath, like a warm bath, right? And and it becomes their home, and it becomes where they can just sort of milk their influence. And these senators who become lobbyists are not being, they're paying, most of them are probably bringing down at least seven figures a year, right? And so
seven figures a year, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
That's a million, right?
Millions, yes. Millions, sometimes $3, $4, or $5 million a year. And again, once you are an insider, that becomes your value proposition. So, the dirty little secret is everyone talks bad about how horrible Washington is, but no one ever leaves. The founders envisioned a capital in which people would come and maybe spend a couple of years and do their service. There's a quaint notion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe return to the farm or reintegrate themselves into the community or their medical practice or whatever it was. And that just doesn't happen anymore. This is now the destination. It's now where people come to get rich and stay comfortable.
And the consequence of that is what? Because you can only begin to see an issue with, the way these guys vote, knowing that in a few months they might be going out and making millions of dollars as a lobbyist for companies on whose legislation they're voting for at any given moment. What's the consequence of all this?
Well, I mean, the consequence of it is you just sort of wonder who they are working for, right? When even when they are in office, or especially when they're in office, you sort of wonder, are they serving the constituents that elected them, or do they have their eyes on the next gig? Do they have their mind set on keeping the friendship with this future employer, you know, as sound as possible, so that they don't jeopardize this next big payday, so that they not jeopardize their big campaign contributions for the next election, and so again, I mean, the whole culture becomes conjoined and sort of, you know, just sort of like sunk into each other, and you just don't know who's working for who. I mean, again, in a simple perfect world, I mean, you figure they're working for their constituents, not the people who are keeping them there or who might employ them next.
But boy, what a scary proposition. And we're seeing more of what you just described out here in the states, Missouri, Kansas. We just had a story in our paper this weekend about the Speaker of the Missouri House making money on the side and some questions that raises, too. I mean, what's happening out there is definitely dripping down out here in the heartland, you know?
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think what Washington is a sort of writ large example of what you see, you know, to some degree in communities. Now, I think the advantage that individual communities have is that they're smaller, and maybe because they're smaller, shame is more possible, right? And and people actually have to face their neighbors in a way that they don't. But no, I mean, Washington is where people come to really exaggerate a lot of the behaviors that they have succeeded in various capitals or communities across the country.
You know, as you're sitting here talking, I'm thinking, you know, again, shortcomings of all of us in the journalism game. And maybe one question we should ask candidates for congressional seats out here and everywhere else is, during the campaign, will you commit not to serve as a lobbyist for at least three years after you leave office? Whenever that time comes, will you commit today never to serve as a lobbyist for at least 3 years? And get that pledge in writing and move on from there.
You know what? I think, look, I mean, I usually, during this point of the conversation, I'll put on my, well, I'm just a journalist, I don't have solutions cap. But I think that's a good idea.
I think it is, too.
I would take it a step further. I would say people should ask people running for office, I mean, will you not lobby and will you return home when you're done? I mean, if it's, say it's a congressional seat and they, I don't know. I mean, I think symbolically it's important for people to leave. One of the things you learn about Washington when you live here and when you cover it is no one ever leaves. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets a second act. There is no fall from grace. I mean, Anthony Weiner, I don't think he'll be elected tomorrow, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind he will get some kind of cable gig, some kind of book deal, some kind of speaking gig. He's going to be fine. He could come back to Washington. I'm sure he'll be fine in New York. I mean, he'll wait it out. I mean, Elliot Spitzer is probably going to be elected tomorrow. And I mean, there is no unemployment line in politics. I would like people, and I think one of the examples in the book that I use is Tom Coburn, who is a senator from Oklahoma, a very conservative senator, who has said, look, I'm going to serve two terms in the Senate, and his term is up in a few years. Then I'm going to go back to Oklahoma. I will not stay in Washington. And look, people say that all the time. They often change their mind. They often lie. I think Tom Coburn, you know, if he strikes me as someone who will not go back on that. But look, I would love there to be an ethic in which people don't stay here, but that's very much entrenched at this point.
Well, you're so spot on. Well, a couple thoughts. Governor Sam Brownback served a couple terms out there, a term in the House, and he left. He lived up to his term limit pledge and came home. You know, but you're so right. This notion that this fall from grace doesn't happen anymore, that people, they get fame, and suddenly all that matters is the fact that people recognize you. What you did doesn't matter anymore. And that's a change, it seems to me, just in the last 5 or 10 or 12 years. That wasn't the case 20 years ago, I don't think.
Right. Well, but think about this. I mean, think about the Republican Revolution of 1994, like the Newt Gingrich Revolution. I mean, one of the big centerpieces of that congressional, you know, that upheaval when the Republicans came into power that year was, I mean, all of them were running on term limits. They were going to say, we're all for term limits. We're going to serve 4 terms, you know, 3 terms, whatever it was, because term limits was a very hot issue back then. And it was a very hot Republican issue back then. I would say that of all the people that have made those pledges Maybe of the majority of them have wiggled out of them. Many of them are still in office now. I mean, it's a joke. I mean, and I have a number of examples in my book of people telling me, no, I will never lobby. And then, of course, they lobby. I think the Obama campaign of 2008 made all kinds of promises about how they weren't going to take money from super PACs, or how they weren't going to work with or weren't going to have lobbyists come into the White House and former lobbyists come into the White House, and they have any number of exceptions. So, look, I mean, once you've had enough of these never minds thrown in your face, I mean, it becomes a little demoralizing and on both sides. I don't think this is a partisan issue at all.
Yeah. Well, I think we've at least charted some new journalistic territory here, because I think out here we can start asking our candidates and have them sign. There's all kinds of no tax pledges in America. How about the no lobbyist pledge for at least 3 years once your term of service is over in D.C.? Yeah. That'd be a good thing to get started out here, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, I mean, there's no penalty for lying. I mean, they're out of office. What do they care? But look, I mean, maybe it'll add just the layer of shame to where maybe they'll think, you know, a third time or a second time or at all about going on and doing something like this.
Mark, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Mark Leibovich. His book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's Gildas Capital. We'll turn to what comes out in this book about one man named Barack Obama. I'm Steve Kraske at the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with Mark Leibovich. His new book, This Town, takes a very hard look at our nation's capital. If you want to join our conversation, we're wondering, what do you think of the way Mark has portrayed Washington, D.C.? 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, before I leave the whole notion of money in Washington, Mark, you talk in the book in detail about how much money can be made out there, because you say in here that the amount these days is no longer in the millions. It's actually in the billions with a B. Do I have that right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if any individuals are pulling down
collectively,
a billion a year.
Collectively.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's like, I mean, there is a lot of money to be made. I mean, look, it's never been easier to I mean, if you sort of look at the lobbying sector, I mean, alone, I mean, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars a year being spent by corporations to influence legislation and influence, you know, individual politicians and so forth. But, yeah, no, I mean, like, the salaries are astounding here. I mean, again, people never used to make that kind of money back. You know, when I first got here, which is only 16 years ago.
In fact, you even
not print journalist.
Yeah, certainly not that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Catastrophes are also fertile ground for making money, you point out, and you talk about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill as an example. Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so BP gets into this big heap of trouble because they caused this were major culprits in this terrible oil spill in 2010. And what I charted around that time, and again, the book sort of runs along a 5-year chronology. This was sort of right in the middle of it. I charted just the flood of oil into the Gulf Coast, but also the flood of money from BP into Washington to try to snap up and lock up, you know, every high-priced Democratic lobbyist, Republican lobbyist, media consultants, pundits, I mean, any number of people who could influence public opinion to try to limit the damage to BP during that crisis. They all of a sudden were working for BP, and I sort of went through this all-star roster of very, very high-priced Democratic and Republican talent, some with close ties to the White House, that were all of a sudden working for BP, and a lot of them were on TV talking as commentators. You didn't know they were working for BP. Some people saw a lot of oil in the Gulf. BP saw a PR problem, and a lot of other people here saw dollar signs.
Let's go back to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Leslie from Leawood. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Steve. I just, there's a lot to say, but what I mostly want to say is that even without a disclaimer that we're just talking about, you know, politicians, there's more to this swirling cesspool you're describing of Washington, D.C. There are really amazing people working in government, on Capitol Hill who are long-term employees and not just politicos, and there are executive branch people, and there are people who don't work in government at all, and people like me who grew up there and live in great communities and who call it hometown. And, you know, it's so easy to get into this jaded perspective. I'm not saying I don't agree with parts of what you and the author are describing, but I just want to caution everybody to pull back a little bit. And the only other point I wanted to make, Steve, is when you commented on Brownback leaving and coming here, let's not forget that he probably has designs on being back in Washington in a very different role, and that's a very different proposition altogether.
All right. Leslie, thanks for the call. Mark, do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a fair point. I absolutely agree with Leslie in that there are probably a majority of people here who work very, very hard, work very anonymously. And look, I mean, again, I've chosen to live here. And one of the good things about living here is that there are some really nice neighbors we have. And these are not people that you see on TV. They're people I see when I drop my kids off at school, and I love them. So, no, it's an important distinction. I mean, I guess there has been a criticism, in fairness, that, you know, Mark didn't really focus on the good people who live anonymously and who just sort of keep their nose to the ground. And that's true. I don't. I mean, not that the people I write about are bad necessarily, but I think these are the people that I, the people I write about are the people who, for better or for worse, are the public face of Washington and also are the people that run your country to some degree. And, you know, this is what my book was about. And I think someone should write a book about the good, hardworking people, too. And I, not that the two are mutually exclusive, but I think that that's a point that needs to be acknowledged. And I appreciate her acknowledging it.
You know, the Huffington Post has come out and a few others have criticized the book, Mark, saying that you report what people are thinking and feeling throughout the book, that when you can't possibly know what they were thinking and feeling. The Huff Post said this: he's like Superman with supersonic insight into what motivates people, even if they have not told him a thing about what motivates them. What about that?
Well, I mean, look, I don't guess people's motivations. I just sort of lay out what they are doing and who they're working for and what their compensation is. And I think, you know, I mean, any good journalist will try to show, not tell. And I don't claim to be a mind reader, and I don't claim to be someone who's going to, you know, say what someone's motives are. I mean, look, I say just explicitly in the book that people are very complicated. Some people are in it for the right reasons. I think motives become particularly muddled over time here, especially when there's money involved. But no, I mean, I don't claim to have any special powers. And I think that it's important, though, to lay out, you know, what the relationships are, what the parties look like, and what just this interwoven, you know, web that we have here looks like for Americans to understand.
We're visiting with Mark Leibovich. His book is number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. It's titled This Town. It looks very, very critically at Washington, D.C. and the people who run our country. You know, you point out some interesting things in the book, Mark, about President Obama himself. You have Henry Kissinger, of all people, saying that Obama, like Richard Nixon, is a loner, but with a difference. Nixon, Kissinger said, liked to have big personalities around him. Obama does not. What do you think he was suggesting there, Mark?
That was a pretty striking comment.
Yes, I thought so, too.
Especially, I mean, you know, someone who served when he served and with Nixon and in the administrations he served in. I mean, I think what he meant was, I mean, the context that you're talking about was it was a chapter about Richard Holbrooke, who was himself a very, very big personality. He was sort of a legendary diplomat. He was the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yes.
He was a big Clinton guy, and the Obama people never really warmed to him. And, you know, Richard was a bit of a handful, and Obama had no use for him at all. I think what Henry Kissinger was saying is that look, I mean, President Obama likes a quiet, loyal, kind of wonky type. And it's true. I mean, the big personalities that you would see around the Clinton people, whether it's, you know, the Stephanopoulos's or the let's see. I mean, you know, Bruce Lindsay wasn't a big personality, but certainly, you know, the Bob Rubin
Carville,
characters,
yeah.
Carville, Begala. I mean, you don't see that here. And I mean, there's much more of a no drama ethic. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And I think it's also interesting to see that the Obama administration hasn't really changed characters that much. I mean, there's certainly been one type that has come through here, and maybe the president would be better served at times with some more colorful colorful personalities. But, you know, obviously he's the president. It's his prerogative. But I thought that that was a revealing quote from Dr. Kissinger.
You would just pay money to have Barack Obama himself join this conversation. And you just wonder what he would say, what he would think about Washington. Well known, he didn't particularly like the town, didn't trust a lot of the people there. And yet, this notion that he was going to be able to change the town, you know, it certainly doesn't seem to have come true here.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't know if he tried as hard as maybe he could have. I don't know what he would say about it. I mean, I agree with you. I'd love to have him in on this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard from a lot of people from the White House about this book. I mean, very positively, actually, and actually quite humbly. I mean, they said, you know, you have good points. I think you're right. I mean, I actually heard from a senator who I won't name him because
sure.
it's a private email, but it was a very sort of humbling, he said, you know, your book has really helped me to look at myself. I think it's important for this town to really see what it has become. I myself, you know, I know it was important. I didn't enjoy reading it at times, but I thought it was both entertaining and both revealing, and I hope you'll write a sequel. And, you know, that was exactly the kind of response I would love to have.
That's what you want.
Love to have. But, and you know, a lot of people in the White House, I mean, I got emails saying, you know, look, we probably shouldn't go to your book party because it might not look good, but why don't a bunch of us take you to dinner? And we did. A bunch of high-level people at the White House that I know and, you know, past and former now, we all had a nice dinner and they told me what they thought. I mean, there were some critiques, but no, I mean, it's been good. But I would obviously love to know what the president thinks. I think he probably has other things to do right now than read a beach book, but who knows? You know?
Let's go back to some calls. Nancy from Fairway. Nancy, you're on Up to Date. Our guest, Mark Leibovich. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to say something that's a little bit on the lighter note. Since you were discussing the topic of lobbyists, I mean, congressmen and senators who become lobbyists and stay on, and wouldn't it be nice if people didn't stay in D.C.? Actually, you've come to the place that is the has probably the prime example of the person who didn't stay in D.C., and that is Harry Truman. When he was finished with his presidential term, got in his Chrysler and drove across the country back to independence, which I've always thought was such a wonderful thing. I also read that he washed out his own socks at night, but that's another story. Yeah. A very humble man and did his service and be at that. There was a book written about his trip across the country with Beth.
Yeah.
In their car, and it was wonderful. I don't remember the name, but they stopped at all the Howard Johnsons and, you know, chatted with people.
So this was after his term was over. They actually got into a car, and they drove back to Independence, Missouri, and stayed at Howard Johnson's along the way.
Exactly. That's what I have always heard. And then, as I say, there's a book written about it. I'm sorry I can't tell you the name.
Oh, I got to read that.
Author. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Terrific. I mean, Harry Truman is this sort of he obviously is an iconic character, and he was obviously a very I mean, a lot of people have invoked him in many contexts in politics. But it's interesting. I interviewed the mayor of Boston last week, Thomas Menino, or a couple weeks ago, who was a classic kind of small town, like really hardworking, completely unglamorous, completely unsmooth workhorse in a business of show horses. And, you know, I guess he's done a very, very good job, and he's retiring now. And over his desk was a huge painting of Harry Truman, which I thought was pretty striking. Now, look, he's a storied figure, but that's a great story.
Yeah, well,
you know, Nancy,
he had a lot of power, and he knew it. He, of course, he's had this famous sign on his desk that said, the buck
stops here.
Good grief, he made one of the biggest decisions ever.
Right.
But he was a very humble man. So,
well, Nancy, I think the title of the book was Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip by Matthew Elgio, if I'm saying that
great.
Right.
I'm glad you know. It was one to read.
Yeah.
I'm going to order that as soon as I get back to my office. That's a great topic.
Thanks, Nancy. You bet.
Thank you.
Well, you know, Mark, if you tour the Truman home in Independence, you know, nearby to where our studios are here, just a few miles down the road, you know, they'll tell you, the tour guides will tell you that as you go through the dining room, that you know, even when he was president, I think that Harry Truman didn't sit at the head of the table. That spot was reserved for Bess Truman's mother, who was still alive then. And I think you do get a sense pretty clearly about why the man, his head was always kept in check. But I think Bess had a lot to do with that here, you know, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, he knew what the hierarchy was.
Yeah, he knew the hierarchy. Mark right. Leibovich is our guest. His book is titled "This Town: Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gildas Capital." Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. I want to go back to your point about Obama and this notion that, you know, he certainly wouldn't disagree with so many of the conclusions that you've made here. Did, when you had your dinner with some of the other high-level administrative types, did they allude to the fact that the president probably would have agreed with a whole lot of what you wrote here?
Yes, I think most people who know him and who have read the book would say that he has. And look, I mean, the feedback has been great. I mean, I've heard from, I mean, without getting specific, I heard from a lot of high-level people and other, you know, people from other administrations. So that's all been gratifying. But I do think that, look, I mean, the president has to govern in this environment. I mean, there's a story towards the end of the book in which the president, I guess it was in the summer of 2011, decides that they're just getting their hat handed to them by the Republicans on the Hill. They just had the debt ceiling crisis. And he said that he convened a Saturday meeting between members of his then fledgling reelection campaign in Chicago and his White House staff. And at the first meeting, he said, "Look, guys, I want these meetings to happen on Saturdays. I want them to happen here in the Roosevelt Room. I want us to trust each other. I want to be open. I want to be frank. I want to have arguments. I want to sort of get back what we had in 2008. And they had a few meetings, and it went really, really well, supposedly. And then in about the sixth meeting, the president said he made a list on a yellow legal pad saying the things that he wished he had been more vocal on in the first term. He wrote about Guantanamo Bay. He wrote about climate change. He wrote about immigration. And a couple days later, Jim Messina, the press secretary or the campaign manager out in Chicago, gets this call from a reporter saying, "Hey, what about this list that the president wrote up at the last meeting?" Messina called the president, said, "Mr. President, apparently there was a leak out of the last meeting." Everyone sort of dreaded what the president was going to say at the next meeting. He shows up at the Saturday, and he addressed it immediately. He said, "Look, guys, I trusted you. I thought what we had was good. These have been tremendous meetings. I really hope they'll continue. But if they do, it'll happen without me." And so he gets up and walks out. Mm. And Vice President Biden, who was sitting, I guess, to his right, you know, chewed out everyone about how they let the president down. He left. And then there was this big soul-searching meeting in which people sort of asked, you know, what happened to us? I mean, did we just get sucked into this whole world of self-dealing and self-interest to where we put it ahead of the president? And finally, Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, or then the former press secretary, was most animated. And he said, you know, "Guys, what happened? I mean, did we change Washington or did Washington change us?" Mm-hmm. And that question sort of runs through the entire narrative of the book. And it sort of, you know, it animates the question of what Washington does to people and what this machine does to people, even with the best of intentions.
You know, what a great story. What an insightful mm-hmm. story. And mm-hmm. and it's interesting to me because, if nothing else, it seems to me the Obama White House has been so disciplined about message and about the lack of leaks, unlike some administrations that leak so much more, the Clinton White House being the prime example here probably.
Right.
But this administration has hardly leaked at all. Am I wrong about that?
I mean, they've leaked quite a bit, actually. I mean, first of all, I mean, the administration has been extremely, I mean, there are two issues here on leaks. I mean, one, there's the Edward Snowden leak part of the conversation, which is, I mean, this has been a very, very aggressive administration when it comes to punishing anyone who would go off the reservation. Now,
right.
obviously, there are national security issues in place, and this is a very complicated thing. But no, I think as things have gone on, as the time has gone on, as more people have become more entrenched in Washington and more really out for themselves and looking for their next job and so forth, people have been much more willing to talk to reporters. And I think, again, that goes to one of the central points of the book, which is that Washington is a city that supposedly was built on public service, but has been increasingly given over to self-service. And again, you see that collision in whether, you know, whether someone is going to increase their own standing of the reporter by leaking versus whether he or she will be loyal to the president by keeping things under wraps.
We have an email here from Beth who writes, you have the population of mostly older white men fully employed with complete health care discussing issues with full-time employed special interest lobbyists or groups. How can they have a clear understanding to make a clear, impartial, informed, realistic decision of all the major problems of the country and millions of the nation's constituents? Would they have delayed voting on health care, unemployment, food stamps, etc., if their own benefits were taken away? Certainly, sequestration should affect them directly. Let's go back to some calls here, and Mike from Roland Park. Mike, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yeah, I just want to state that I agree with the comment about term limits. I've always thought term limits were a bad idea because the people who work in the federal government are there indefinitely. The lobbyists are certainly there indefinitely. So I think term limits really is kind of backfired in a way. The other point I wanted to make is I really think that we're in a democracy. People have become so cynical about it, but the real issue is a lot of people don't participate. And I think one way they can participate right now that's important is working on this move to amend a proposal to amend the Constitution, prevent corporations from being treated like citizens. Mm. That's my comment.
All right, Mike. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah. Annabelle writes us this, Mark, is the increasing presence of women in Washington making a difference in the issues they're discussing? Good question.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it clearly has. I mean, I think it's not just in Washington. I mean, I think it's reflective of the country. I think there's a long way to go. I mean, I think the Obama administration, which is, you know, avowed, obviously, I mean, should, you would think, be more progressive than in the past, has actually been criticized for being kind of an insider's boys club. Have not been a lot of women in the inner circle. But no, look, I mean, I think that Washington has been changed somewhat, but I also think in large part, if you look around here, it's still very much a male-dominated sport, politics is, and so there's a long way to go.
Is there a sequel to this book?
A lot of people have asked me that.
Yeah. They're probably right nervous now, about that.
Well, I don't know if they're nervous about it. The one person who's nervous about it is my wife, because she doesn't want to go through this again, meaning the 3 years of research and writing in a closed office where while I have three little kids that she's doing most of the raising of. So no, I don't know yet. I mean, look, I've been gratified by the interest in it, but right now I have no plan.
And just quickly, Mark, there's no index to this book because
because I wanted people to actually read it. There's this thing called the Washington Read where people in Washington who think they're important will go into a bookstore, they'll see a book, and they will check for themselves in the index. And when they're not there or if they're mentioned just in passing, they will shove it back and they will not buy it. So I wanted people to buy it.
Mark,
I want you to buy it.
Yes.
Support an independent bookstore.
And we do a lot of that out here, you bet. Mark Leibovich's book is titled This Town. Mark, you've been such a great guest. Thanks for taking some time.
Great. Thanks, Steve. It was fun.
All the best. You bet.
Okay.
Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. Again, his new book is titled This Town. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR News, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.